From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we continue our coverage in the debate over medical marijuana. Last week, we heard from officials of the LDS Church. The church is the most powerful group in a coalition opposing the ballot initiative legalizing cannabis for medical purposes, and they've raised a number of concerns. So we'll get a response from those who have been working for years now to make medical marijuana legal in Utah. After this.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. In politics, they say you shouldn't really pay attention to the polls until September. That's when people really start thinking about a candidate or an issue. They start working out their opinion and their vote. Polling for the initiative on the ballot in November that would legalize medical marijuana seems to have settled right now at around the mid-60s in support of the initiative. That's Proposition 2. It was in the mid-70s, but it started to move, to drop, when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints joined this coalition of groups opposing Prop 2, and the church became unusually vocal about the issue. They offered us three general authorities last week to talk about the church's position, and so we took them up on it. But of course, it wouldn't have been fair to just leave it at that. The officials made some claims about the initiative, about the motives of its supporters. They said it lacked safeguards. They said it was too permissive. So today in the program, we're going to be hearing a response from some of the people who have been working for years now to make medical cannabis legal in the state. Joining us today in the program is Connor Boyack. He is the president of the Libertas Institute. That's a libertarian think tank here in Utah. It's involved in the drafting of the Medical Marijuana Initiative. Mm-hmm. And Connor Boyack, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Christine Stenquist, also with us, the president and co-founder of the advocacy group Truce, Together for Responsible Use and Cannabis Education. And welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we also have with us Dr. Dan Cottom. He's a bariatric surgeon practicing in Utah, also has a license to practice in Nevada. He's a supporter of Proposition 2. He's joining us here. And welcome to you, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Connor Boyack and Christine Stenquist, I want to begin with you. I want to work through a little bit, get your reaction to our conversation last week with three of the representatives of the LDS Church and what you heard. Clearly, there was a theme for them. A less charitable way of looking at it was a talking point. You kept hearing this from them again and again. Elder Jack Gerard principally was the one who mentioned this. He said this: our primary focus is to relieve human pain and suffering, to help those individuals who struggle in this life to make sure they have a good quality of life. So in one form or another, we heard a lot of that, that what they're about is relieving human pain and suffering. Connor Boyack, to you too. What do you make of that?
So it's important to understand the history of this ever so briefly. Our organization, along with Christine and her organization, we've been at this for years legislatively. And when we were working with Senator Madsen, I was in the room with the senator and the two church representatives, sometimes pejoratively called the home teachers, the lobbyists who will come up to the Hill. And it was the four of us in that room where they delivered the message that they were taking a position of opposition to the senator's bill. They were effectively killing it. In that meeting, I asked for details. I said, look, every other organization that has concerns has offered specifics as to what their concerns are so that we can validate them, amend the bill, try and take that into account and improve the bill to satisfy the concerns of the opposition. I said, would you guys provide us with details, yeah. and none were offered. So I think the frustration...
Why do you think none were offered?
I don't know that they understood the issue deeply enough or felt that it was a threat enough to do that. Now it's a threat, right? It's on the ballot. The polling is the way it is. And I think it's a little more of a threat where they feel they have to respond to it, whereas before they could make it go away. And so I think the frustration that a lot of the public now feel or feel still is that the high-level talking points, as you called it, are offered, high-level principles that we might even agree with. We want to relieve human suffering. We want to avoid unintended consequences. But there's no details. And until we can address very specific arguments back and forth, I think it's an less productive conversation.
Christine, how much of this is being driven by concerns about recreational marijuana on the part of the Mormon Church?
I think that's a talking point for them, but if they'd read the bill, they would see that this isn't a recreational bill. So I think it's a red herring that they keep trumpeting that. I think most of us in Utah are concerned about recreational. This isn't a state that people look at and go, yeah, recreational will fly in that state. For sure. Before we ventured down this road of doing an initiative, which was not our first choice, we had done several goes at trying to do it legislatively. We looked at polling, and there's no appetite in this state for recreational. So while I appreciate their concerns and I am in agreement with their concerns, it's unfounded, especially in regards to Prop 2.
Christine, you have said that the church told you, and I wanted to ask you about this, that in essence, and well, not in essence, here's a direct quote, at least as you've mentioned it to us, that a war is coming.
Yes.
What do you mean by that? You said you received an email laying out basically their strategic game plan, and by them, I guess you mean the LDS Church.
Earlier this year in June, the Patients organization wanted to sit down with the church and figure out what their concerns were about this bill. They have come at us in a very aggressive manner. There were lawsuits that were filed earlier this year, and I'm trying to wrap my head around why they are coming at us so aggressively and not in the compromising language that we're hearing now. The meeting that I attended with some other advocates, Marty, those were his words.
Mention who, well, let me explain who Marty Stevens, who is now a lobbyist for the LDS Church, and we should say for 6 years served as Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Yes. So, yes, we had a meeting with Marty, and in that meeting, we offered researchers, scientists, we offered policy creators across the country, experts on this particular issue to them, and hopes to getting to some sort of compromise for 2019. We had no intention of stopping the initiative. There was me and another co-signer in that meeting. Him and I had agreed that that was not even an option. What we were trying to do is look at 2019, when the legislative body would come together and the church would definitely be a player at that. That was not Marty's intentions. His intentions was stopping the initiative. And his words were, war is coming. And he laid out how much money would be spent on this war. And
how much?
$5 to $10 million. And the Patients organization doesn't have that, nor does the campaign, to be all in honesty. We knew, Connor and I both knew from the very beginning, that bringing this issue to this community was going to be tricky, and we had to walk with integrity and be very careful about who we engaged with. Connor looked to an organization that might be able to help us because they have run other initiatives. Because of our affiliation with that organization that has the expertise on this issue.
What organization are you talking about?
MPP, okay. Marijuana Policy Project. It's a national organization, but they have the skill set in navigating this issue. And because of our small affiliations with them and the small amount of money that has been raised to get this initiative on the ballot, we have been demonized of being in pursuits of some sinister plan to, you know, turn Utah into a recreational state.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I wonder if Christine or you, Connor, feel like in some ways that may have been a strategic mistake, because that is one of the, I'll use the word talking points again, yeah, that you're hearing, that there's this big national organization that whose ultimate goal is recreational marijuana. They're funding, providing strategy for this organization, that this is being run by an outside organization. Well, how do you respond to that?
So Libertas Institute is the second largest funder of the initiative. So mm-hmm. by no means are we an insignificant player in terms of getting this supported. And as you introduced us, and as we're well known, we're a very libertarian-leaning organization. So absent MPP's involvement, we would have been fielding the same arguments. We even mm-hmm. are now where the Utah Medical Association and others are claiming, oh, they're libertarians, they want recreational. Those same assumptions are made. We wouldn't have avoided those talking points by denying MPP involvement. And MPP does bring a lot to the table. They've succeeded in other states. They know how to run ballot initiatives. We don't. That's not something that's in our wheelhouse. We hadn't done that before. And so the access to more funds to try and even the playing field that Christine mentioned, that our opponents, Walter Plum, Kem Gardner more recently, $100,000 each, we have to raise money to see this, the public will achieved and the polling realized in terms of policy. So I think it was a strategically smart move in our sense to utilize the wisdom and the resources of those who've gone before, knowing that had we not done so, the same arguments would have been presented. They just would have been more focused against Libertas.
If I may interject, knowing that, though, we knew that this had to be a grassroots organization. There had to be done by the people of Utah. And that's why you see such a strong presence of patient organizations, people volunteering for Utah Patients Coalition. It is a very grassroots effort here in Utah. MPP is not here as boots on the ground. It's us.
I want to go through here in a moment some of the, I guess, the legal questions that have been raised, particulars to Proposition 2. Curtin McConkie, the LDS Church, commissioned this legal analysis by the law firm Curtin McConkie. And then you responded, Connor. And then there was a rebuttal to the rebuttal. And we're not going to go through all of this. But what the response said was that your response wasn't really a legal rebuttal, but it was, and I'll quote them here, an assertion of your own libertarian policy preferences. So there again, the term libertarian, which mm-hmm. you don't
shy away from
in any way. No. But I guess the rebuttal points out that Libertas appears to favor full legalization of marijuana. So I want to get that out of the way. They say that this initiative is just a big step in that direction. Respond to that ultimately what you really want is just full legalization of recreational and medicinal marijuana in the state of Utah.
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond. I've responded publicly in legislative meetings. I've responded to legislators and legislative leadership who have asked this. At no time will Libertas Institute in the future be pushing for recreational marijuana. It's not in our game plan. It's not our intentions. As a matter of preference, we think it is rather stupid policy to lock people in a cage to disrupt their family life, their financial situation, their employment, because they ingested a substance in their basement. That's just bad policy. If we look to Portugal, if we look elsewhere where they're treating drug use, which we object to, we don't want people being intoxicated, certainly if they're driving or going to work. It's not a Libertas thing. That's not something we want for our society or that I want personally, right? So as a matter of policy, we think treating it as a public health issue rather than as a criminal justice issue is smarter. It's a better use of taxpayer resources. It's more restorative justice, helping the person overcome their problems. So we're not going to be out there trying to legalize recreational marijuana. And the important point to point out in this discussion is that no time has Proposition 2 ever been an attempt to try and mask recreational marijuana as medical. As Christine pointed out, we know what the polling says on recreational marijuana. It's not in our intention to do that. And notwithstanding Proposition 2 being among the most heavily and conservatively regulated systems, medical programs in the country, we still field these arguments that, oh, it's recreational. Look, this has been an argument in every state against medical marijuana. The sky is falling, the slippery slope. So it's predictable that we're seeing it now. We can dispense with that by publicly stating that it's simply not in the game plan. It's never been in our intent, and it's rather a talking point of the opposition to try and deter people from supporting Proposition 2.
Is recreational marijuana inevitable once a state legalizes it for medicinal purposes?
Absolutely not. What I really foresee on the federal level is that there is probably going to be a rescheduling of cannabis at some point in the near future. And what you will also see is states' rights being...
What makes you say that, near future, with the Trump administration and resistance by Attorney General Jeff Sessions?
Currently, we have over 55 pieces of legislation on the federal level that is addressing this issue. So there is movement. There is a desire. There's an appetite coming from across the country to move on this issue. As far as recreational goes for this state or any other state, I really think you're going to see states' rights issues be trumpeted. I think you will see people who are in different states want different things. Some states will be recreational, like you see in your more liberal states. Conservative states will hold tight to that medical line. I think Utah will be one of those states.
We've never not admitted, Doug, that people will abuse this program. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, there will be people who falsely obtain a medical card, and that is what the opponents will say. Oh, therefore it's recreational. No.
I wanted to ask you, what is the essence of the LDS Church's opposition or general opposition? Are these arguments that you're hearing based on, you know, maybe cultural impressions that are dated, the whole kind of reefer madness concern that you heard a lot of in the 60s and 70s? And clearly the church opposes marijuana based on its word of wisdom. It's one of those things that it prohibits. So I'm wondering just your general impression of the opposition that you're hearing to it. Are these dated impressions that you're sensing, I suppose?
So I think in one of the LDS Church's responses to an online newsletter called The Beehive, they asked all of the supporting and opposing organizations to respond. And in that, the church cited, as it has elsewhere, statistics about Colorado, right? And they'll say, well, look, after Colorado passed a medical program, marijuana-related hospitalizations and increased. And okay, that's not untrue. The fact is that as more people are ingesting marijuana, if they go into the hospital because they cut their hand off on a saw, they're going to get logged in the system as a marijuana-related hospitalization just because they have legal medical cannabis in their system. Relying on statistics like that don't actually show a problem. They just show that, well, yeah, more people are using it. That's not necessarily indicative of a problem. It seems the church has been relying on many such statistics, especially from Colorado, where our opponents love to look, not at the two dozen other states that have functioning normal medical programs without any recreational problems, as would Utah have under Prop 2. Relying on those, I think, is more a reflection.
But wait, what do you mean by that? What is Please. Colorado worse than Oregon?
Well, Colorado is recreational.
Yeah.
And Colorado's medical program was very loosely done, as was California's, right? I mean, so the fact that Utah has learned from all these other states in creating Prop 2.
Well, that's a contention we actually heard from the church officials last time, is that we can learn from those who are doing it well and who aren't. You're saying maybe
We've
Colorado didn't do, so you've already done that.
Yeah.
You can see the point that Colorado may not have done it exactly right.
But Colorado is not even close to what Utah's got going on.
You agree with that their point.
We've stated that point ourselves. Okay. Proposition 2, as was Senator Madsen's bill before it, was a reflection of learning from other states' mistakes. We fully agree that we can and should incorporate those things into what we're doing. At the end of the day, really it comes down to is this kind of speculative fear and poor statistics that aren't really relevant, or are we talking about compassion and science and criminal justice? And that's the conversation we've been pushing. We feel that the church's position are based on very weak statistics and misleading information. And that was our response to the Curt McConkie rebuttal, is it was full of misleading information.
That's Connor Boyack. He's the president of the Utah-based Libertas Institute. We also have with us Christine Stenquist, president and co-founder of the advocacy group Truce. And also with us is Dr. Dan Cottom. He's a surgeon practicing in Utah and Nevada and a proponent of Proposition 2. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our coverage in the debate over medical marijuana. Last week, we heard from officials of the LDS Church who are opposing Proposition 2. Today, we're getting a response from those who've been working for years now to make medical marijuana legal in Utah. We have with us Connor Boyack, president of the Utah-based Libertas Institute, Christine Stenquist, president and co-founder of the advocacy group Truce, and Dr. Dan Cottom, a surgeon practicing in Utah and Nevada. What church officials told us last week is this, and I want to quote them. And this is Elder Jack Gerard again. He said, "There is science that suggests marijuana is not helpful to the human body." Which is kind of a broad, general sort of thing. So let's get particular. And Dr. Cottom, I want to hear from you on this question. What is marijuana good for in a medical way? And I know that's a complicated answer, but what is it helpful for? What is it good for?
Well, there is what we call level one data, and that means that it's the best data that you can get surrounding certain medical conditions. Multiple sclerosis is one, and some forms of epilepsy is another. And what they call neuropathic pain is another, where pain in the distal fibers of your nerves, like in your fingertips and toes, like with diabetics, and certain conditions related to drugs killing nerves. This is absolutely wonderful medicine for that. Additionally, and they've actually mapped this.
Why is that? What does it do?
Well, without going into cellular receptors and how they interact.
Yeah, maybe it's hard to answer that question without going into cellular receptors.
I can tell you this. As a basic level, they have what they call cannabinoid receptors, for lack of a that's how they name them, since they interact with it. And the interesting thing is these cannabinoid receptors on our pain fibers interact with the same pain receptors that narcotics interact with. And so what happens is, since they have intersecting pathways, they actually act synergistically. So say if you're a person who needs 5 or 10 milligrams of Percocet a day for their neuropathic pain or whatever it is, if you take medicinal marijuana, they interact together. They lower the need for both drugs. So you take less of the medicinal marijuana, but you take less of the narcotics as well. So anytime you take less of something, it's usually better. So we see this happening all over in medicine now with high blood pressure meds. They're all combination meds now. And so the absolute level of toxicity for both is decreased. So medical marijuana works in a range of conditions. In addition to patients who suffer from chronic nausea, for instance, people at end of life. There's no question that the benefit to the patient, not only psychoactively, they feel better. You know, you're going to be dying in a certain a number of months, but also pain-wise, it deals with that as well. Mm-hmm. So these are things that no one's even disputing that they're good, right? And it works fabulously for. And so the most important thing to realize about all this is that medicinal marijuana, of the many drugs that we have available to treat pain, is the safest. And when I say that, I'm throwing in Motrin, I'm throwing in Tylenol, I'm throwing in aspirin, I'm throwing in all the narcotics. So if you have to take the drugs that we use to treat pain as physicians on a day-to-day basis, medicinal marijuana is by far, not even close, the safest option for patients out there. And so, from a medical perspective, why wouldn't you use the safest pain reliever available?
Doctor, I wanted to get you. You've talked to us about contrasting patients. We had a patient in California, a woman, I believe, one who lives in Utah, and the differing results because one could use marijuana and one couldn't. Would you tell us that story?
I received a phone call on the same day from two people who I know very well. Their spouses had both undergone spine surgery. They both had spine fusions. One was in Utah, one was in California. And it was interesting to watch the result. They called me up for advice, and I told the one in Utah, I said, unfortunately, you can't take more Motrin because that impairs the healing of their bones. And you have the only option in Utah is to take more narcotics for your pain, which was keeping her up all night. It's a side effect of it. And making her nauseated, which was another side effect. And she was still in great pain. She couldn't go to rehab. and she was forced to stay home and could almost do nothing. The one in California, I said, listen, go down to your little medical dispensary for medicinal marijuana, get some dosages, and see how it affects. And within a few hours, she was able to sleep. The next day, she was able to participate in her day-to-day activities and attend rehab. The difference was dramatic, but more importantly was that she was able to cut her narcotics usage in half from the day she started doing that. Mm-hmm. Now, if we want to talk about responding to the opioid epidemic, and if we want to talk about safety, the fact that people are fighting this makes no sense at all. It is a non-starter. If we're concerned about patient care and advocacy, we should all be on board with this. And the fact is, they're not.
Doug, the Journal of the American Medical Association about 4 years ago published a study where they looked at states that had legalized medical marijuana, and they looked at their opioid overdose fatality rates both before and after the medical cannabis was legalized. What they found in looking at a whole bunch of states, this wasn't like the opposition focusing on California or Colorado, they looked at a whole bunch of states, they found that there was a 25% reduction in opioid overdose fatalities as a result of passing medical marijuana. And among the answers, I think, are what Dr. Cottom is talking about. People can get away with using less opioids or no opioids in some cases. And where our opponents claim that marijuana is a gateway drug, this 80s dare, reefer madness style argument, in fact, what you find, what I've found for many patients I've gotten to know, especially in Christine's group, is that cannabis, medical cannabis, is a gateway out. It's not a gateway into harder drugs. It's a gateway out of these horrible, potentially fatal drugs.
Christine, could you talk about your own experience with chronic migraines and the fact
yes.
that you use marijuana for medicinal purposes yourself?
I do, and openly admit that here in Utah that I'm breaking the law. But I have used cannabis as my gateway out. I was on a fentanyl patch, 100 micrograms, being changed every other day. My breakthrough pain shots were Dilaudid. I was given 60 Percocets a month to have at home. This was on top of my antidepressants, my antispasmatics, my muscle relaxers, and a whole other slew of medication to keep me going. My road down a pharmaceutical-free life is purely because of cannabis. It's changed my entire outlook on life. I was bedridden for 16 years on heavy pharmaceuticals because of these debilitating migraines. I also suffer from trigeminal neuralgia, which is a debilitating nerve condition. It's also dubbed the suicide disease. The pain is quite excruciating, and there is no cure, which means at 24, when I had brain surgery, that was my lot in life. I was going to be set on this path for just pain. No narcotic can touch it. Not a thing. I mean, I was on fentanyl suckers and chewing through those things like they were candy, and it did nothing to help the pain. Cannabis has given me a quality of life. I am out of bed. I am experiencing a whole new world of relief. And I never had that with any FDA-approved drug that I have taken, not even nerve ablations and trigger point injections. Nothing gave me the relief that I'm getting from cannabis. And that's why I fight, as I know firsthand that this can help many patients. Now, it's not a panacea, and it's not going to cure everybody, and not everybody's going to have the exact same results that I have. Each patient is uniquely different. And I try to teach that into the community. But what I do want to emphasize is I feel strongly that every patient should have an opportunity to legally try this as an avenue for relief. And I think every physician should have the ability to have that honest conversation with their patients.
I want to ask Dr. Cottom. One of the arguments we heard from church officials last week, and this is something expressed, of course, by other opponents of the initiative, and that is that we just don't know enough about marijuana yet, about the side effects, about the risks. Is that true?
Well, in the sense that you can never know enough about something, right? How many times have we seen high blood pressure meds change and go through fads? So we're always learning. And this isn't to say that we shouldn't stop learning, but if you go to the common medical search engine, it's called PubMed, and you put in medicinal marijuana, you get over 4,000 references to scholarly articles. Okay, that doesn't sound like something that's been barely studied.
There was another contention, just while you're on this point, made by opponents of the initiative, that it does, and I'll quote the, I think this is the Curtin McConkie assessment, it does not require a physician providing these recommendations to have any training or experience with the effects of marijuana.
Well, there's two arguments to that. Number one, the legislature could, as soon as the proposition passed, just like I have a license in Nevada, they require me to have a little bit of training on that. But number two, we don't require physicians to prescribe aspirin, Motrin, or Tylenol. We can go into any store and get those. Yet those drugs are all much more dangerous and put countless people in the hospital, like thousands of people in the hospital every year, and kill people every year. And so the point that we need to make sure that we understand with medicinal marijuana is that when you look at the safety profile, the reason why you don't need necessarily a physician to be directly involved with it is because the risk of death is so low. I mean, there's a great statistic. When you go out and look at the CDC or the FDA, and they compile statistic after statistic for who dies from what, and when you look under marijuana, the number's always zero. And now you sit back and say, really? We have people smoking marijuana recreationally all over the country. In fact, my children who go to Woods Cross High School tell me they know exactly where they can get marijuana in 5 minutes on campus any time of the day. So people are using this everywhere. And yet the CDC still says nobody's died from it. So now we want to make this available for people who have debilitating conditions. Well, they don't need a physician because this drug isn't going to kill you.
Is it addictive?
Absolutely. But it's just as addictive as caffeine. Now think about it. They're both psychoactive substances. Can you give up your Coke or coffee in the morning?
It's a tough question.
It's a tough question for some people. But the truth is that on relative addiction, and I'm just saying, we don't stop people from going and buy alcohol. Most researchers would say alcohol is 100 to 150 times more addictive. And I don't want to get into the scales because when you look at the fine details, every researcher, there's flaws in every study, right? But generally across the board, alcohol is 100 to 150 times more addictive. So the question for people is something is that safe? Does it really need to be regulated like a drug that has serious consequences? And we've gotten over it with Tylenol and Motrin. But for some reason, we're stuck on this, and I don't understand it, but it's true that we are. Reefer madness, I think it is, honestly.
Well, I want to get – which raises a bigger question, though, and that is that you make this sound so great, but this may impose some kind of permissive attitude about a drug that has a powerful effect on people or has an effect on people for sure when they're driving, when you're young.
So
I want to get you to respond to that.
So let's look at Massachusetts. Massachusetts decriminalized possession of marijuana in 1998. It made medicinal marijuana in 2012, and then it made full recreational in 2018. From the time it decriminalized it to now, there's been no change in mortality. As a matter of fact, at the whole time that this is happening, Massachusetts has a third lower death rate per mile driven than Utah does.
Well, how do you explain that? Because if you don't want someone who's stoned driving a car, right?
Well, this is true, but you have to remember, we want to look at alcohol and marijuana as exactly the same, and they're not. This isn't the same, but I'm going to give you a rough example, okay? When you say, I'm going to smoke enough marijuana and impair my ability, it would be equivalent to drinking about a bottle and a half of wine. So you really have to be serious about what you're doing to do it. So it's not that it's not bad, and it's not that we want it to happen, but the relative amount that you have to do is so high that most people never get to that point, okay? So you smoke a half a joint, you're very unlikely to impair your ability to drive down the road safely.
what was mentioned, and I want to hear all of you on this question because it seems like a serious point. The church officials mentioned that there was a jump, a significant jump in marijuana-related road fatalities. Connor, you were sort of responding to this earlier. 26% increase in marijuana use by youth.
Right.
This is also not true.
Okay, so respond to that, because that was a contention made last week.
Maybe I'll say for Christine that the youth increased, because there's been national studies debunking that. I'll save that one for her for when she jumps in. Since I had brought up the other point, I'll respond to that.
Yeah.
I had mentioned marijuana-related hospitalizations. This one is pertaining to driving. At the end of the day, if I'm a teenager in Colorado, or let's say I'm 20, right? I'm legally using recreationally, and I'm texting while driving, but I haven't used cannabis for 2 weeks. The metabolite is still in my body. It can be detected for up to a month. But if the officer suspects foul play or cannabis or alcohol or whatever, they do a blood draw. They find that I had the cannabis metabolite in my body, and I will get logged as a marijuana-related, you know, car accident or vehicle fatality. That has nothing to do with impairment. Look, it's very safe to say that every single Proposition 2 proponent does not want impaired drivers, whether that's from cannabis, opioids, alcohol, you know, other prescription drugs, benzodiazepines. I mean, nobody wants unsafe driving. Proposition 2, based on studies that have happened elsewhere, does not suggest that that will be the case. But to suggest that in Colorado more cannabis users happen to be getting in car accidents that had nothing to do with cannabis, it's not a very strong statistic for the church or any opponent to be relying upon in furtherance of their agenda to oppose Prop 2.
As a matter of fact, there has been no state that has passed either medicinal cannabis or recreational cannabis that has seen an increase in mortalities. So it's important to say how many deaths happened per mile driven, and they're exactly the same. They use the same thing with teenagers, right? They say, well, you know, more teenagers are going to smoke. But you know what? Teenager use of marijuana spiked to its highest all-time level in 98. Since that time, it has come down, not by a little bit, by a third. Mm-hmm. A third. And this is true everywhere, not only in the U.S. and every state, and Connor will back me up on this, but in states like Massachusetts. The truth is recreational marijuana is already available to our teenagers, and this doesn't change that availability. So the people who are going to try marijuana, whatever it is, are going to try it regardless of their distance to a dispensary or not.
The one point I just really want to make is teenagers are going to be getting cannabis if they want it for recreational use. What a program actually does establish is it actually puts some safeguards up. We actually start prohibiting teenagers from gaining access because they can't get into dispensaries.
Teenage use has gone down in the states, actually, where they've made medicinal marijuana legal.
Mm-hmm. Why
Correct.
Do you think? Why?
I don't know why.
Because they regulate it more? Or
it's regulated, and honestly, the romanticism of what cannabis is taken away. We are teaching our children that this is medicine, and it should be handled appropriately. You go to the doctor to get a recommendation. They see commercials of old people right. who are needing it for their arthritis. That's not sexy. That's not something that a teenager wants to be associated with.
And we've already established that we're on the same page with our opponents in not wanting recreational
Agreed.
And not wanting youth access. And look, the way this process works is that if Proposition 2 passes, the legislature just 2 months later can repeal the whole thing, can tweak the whole thing. And if there are any reasonable changes that our opponents can come to the table with in specific details and say, here's how we think we can tweak it to make sure that there's no youth access. That's never been the intent. Mm-hmm. The idea is let's talk about specifics.
You're fine with the tweaking.
No one's been opposed to that, but tweaking is different than undermining.
Correct.
If we're tweaking...
We're going to get to that, by the way.
If we're tweaking to honor the original intent, that's one thing. There's one important point to add, I think, to color what Dr. Cottom was saying. And it's a point we've made in private conversations with legislators who feel inadequate to make this decision back when we were asking the legislature to do it. I can't tell you how many times Christine and I heard, we're not qualified to say whether this is good science or not, or whether this is medicine. We're elected officials. We're not scientists. To which our response is, and now is to the public, Proposition 2 is not a scientific question. It's a criminal justice one. All we're saying is Let's tell our police and prosecutors to leave people like Christine alone, who, together with their physicians like Dr. Cottam, are going to be using this because it's helping. And yes, we want more research. Yes, the science will improve over time. But this is not a scientific question. All we're asking is, should police arrest and should prosecutors charge patients who are using this under their supervision authority? You don't have to be a doctor to answer that question.
Church officials are asking what the impacts of not just – I shouldn't just say it's just church officials. Other opponents are asking if what are the impacts on law enforcement. They mentioned, for example, in that legal analysis, if you show a police officer a label that says this marijuana was legally purchased as medicinal marijuana, who's to say that that's true?
Yeah.
That have to come right out and admit it. That's really difficult. How are you supposed to know if you're a law enforcement official if someone is driving under the influence of marijuana? How do you know who's allowed to possess it? This is really complicated for law enforcement. How do you respond to that?
Well, like the medical associations, the law enforcement groups in every medical state opposed the medical program before it was enacted. And you hear over the years and here in Utah all sorts of fear about the sky is falling, we won't be able to enforce this. That's not true. Recreational use is being enforced against and prosecuted in medical-only states. The same will apply to Utah. Law enforcement under Proposition 2 have full access to the database showing if, for example, Christine is a patient, if she purchased her cannabis from a dispensary, on what date within the past 60 days, they would have full records of that. The point is that law enforcement has the full ability, if Christine or any patient is pulled over, to do their work, to investigate. Now, some law enforcement may prefer it be a little easier by just banning this entirely, but we're asking the public to tell them, sorry, you and prosecutors are going to have to do a little more work to identify and investigate. Well, Christine, you say you got this from a dispensary. When did you do that? Do you have a receipt? Right? Like, can we actually legitimately verify if she is a patient or not? I don't think it's too much of a problem to ask law enforcement if they indeed want to prosecute people, charge, arrest, and prosecute people, that they do the work rather than just right now making an assumption that's easy. Oh, marijuana is bad. You're being arrested. I don't care if there's any other circumstances such as you're a patient. Yeah, it's going to be tougher for them. We don't deny that, but it's not going to be impossible. And the claims being made by many opponents in that regard are dubious.
Why allow them to destroy sales records?
This is a federally illegal substance. Okay. And so even if we legalize it under state law, we don't want to give the federal government a treasure trove of access. And this is an important point here in Utah. A lot of people don't understand. Dr. Cottam can talk about the controlled substance database. Every time you go get a prescription drug, let's say an opioid, you are logged in a database. And there is a lawsuit recently in which the federal government gained access. They won in court. The state was defending, the feds, the DEA were prosecuting or trying to get this overturned, and they won. Right now, the federal government no longer needs a warrant to gain access to your personal medical history, your sensitive prescription drug access within this database. So if under Proposition 2 we're creating this central database for cannabis users, what we're saying is because this is a federally illegal product, we want to give a window in which law enforcement can do their investigative work. But after that point, we want to protect the patients from federal law. And look, if federal law ever changes and that's rescheduled, I think we'd all be open to eliminating that 60-day requirement, say treat it like any other prescription drug.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear. It seems like the I'm not sure if all opponents are, but the LDS Church last week, they seemed to be conceding this point that what you were hearing from a lot of opponents is, hey, you can't prescribe this, which is impossible because you can't prescribe a drug that is federally illegal.
Correct.
Right. And it seems like the church is finally conceding that point that, yeah, that's impossible. What they explained to us was that they were just setting the bar really high. And they said that now they're willing to compromise on that point, which I think is interesting. What do you make of that? Is that a show of good faith? Or what, I mean, the fact that they're willing to compromise on that as a talking point, as a matter?
You set a bar up here, the impossible, and then you say, oh, but we're willing to compromise. That doesn't sound like a compromise to me. It doesn't sound like they understand this issue. And again, if they're listening, I still have researchers and policymakers across the country that would be willing to help educate the church on this point.
I think a lot of critics feel that the church stepped in it a little bit. They thought that they were being advised that this was a potential, not only, Doug, as you point out, with physicians prescribing, but also with pharmacies dispensing. And I don't have access to their intelligence and their conversations to know whether they knew that that was basically impossible or not before they said it. Regardless, I find it heartening that the church is now signaling that, look, in fact, Marty Stevens earlier this week had said, we're not insisting anything. We're part of a coalition exploring best practices. I think that's healthy. And again, from our perspective, where we were asking for those details years ago, even at this 11th hour, we're still saying, let's talk details rather than high-level concepts.
Well, former Speaker Stevens is also, through the LDS Church, asking lawmakers to legalize medicinal marijuana in a special legislative session after the vote. What do you make of that? I mean, it seems like in some way what Marty Stevens has been quoted as saying is he says our thinking is that we go through the election, have a special session one way or the other to make sure that we've got this right. What does that tell you, Connor Boyack? Does it indicate they think they may not have the votes that this is going to pass?
I think the church, the governor's office, and others are polling this and watching this closely. In fact, we have knowledge of our opposition's internal polling, which confirms our internal polling and the public polling. That is to say, notwithstanding all of the opposition arguments being used, claiming that Proposition 2 is recreational, claiming that medical marijuana is already legal, these false assertions, notwithstanding using those arguments, Proposition 2, according to everybody's polls, still passes. So I think no longer is the conversation about let's do a special session beforehand. Now it's this concept of what about a special session after? And we side with the governor, and that is to say you can't hold a special session without any details. There's still no details. Maybe what the church comes up with is 99% of what's in Proposition 2, to which maybe some of the Proposition 2 proponents would feel better about that. But if it's 40% of what we wanted, that's a different conversation. We can't talk about a special session without knowing what they're actually planning, and then we can respond.
I would challenge, too, these legislators that are leaving, we have 30 of them that are leaving, were also the same legislators that Connor and I have been dealing with for the past several years who were opposed to our efforts. So I'm sort of looking at this special session request as a lame duck session, and I don't see it being good. I just don't see it being good.
What effect do you figure the church's more vocal involvement in this issue, and by the church I mean the LDS Church, what sort of influence do you think it's had on the process? I guess you've seen the polling that shows there was about a 10-point dip, so it's having some influence, but it seems to be holding steady. What are you making of what you're seeing polling-wise?
Very, very, very few people are undecided at this point. And while many conservative, active Mormons were persuaded by the church's opposition and did change their point of view because many of them feel that this is God speaking, this is what the Lord wants us to do, that had the opposite effect for people who aren't Mormon. In fact, the opposition, or rather the support for Proposition 2 became more entrenched, especially among Catholics, atheists, agnostics, and others. And so, I think the problem here is that when no solutions are being offered, when no specifics are being offered, it looks like to a lot of people that that's interference and unproductive interference. So certainly many conservative Mormons, of which I am one, will take that message to mean, notwithstanding my support or my mom needing it or whatever, I'm now going to oppose it because they must see something I don't. But then you have the opposite reaction as well. Some sort of Newtonian political law happening here about opposite reactions. But at the end of the day, like, I want to respond to this, Doug. Perhaps it's more akin to what your audience has been saying online that I've seen more of, more from kind of the left, progressive, liberal side of our state. And that is this argument that the church should butt out, or we should tax the church. We don't agree with either of those points. I would love to see every church, every nonprofit, every group speaking its mind, sharing its perspective. I think that's healthy for our republic. I think that's good for our community. What I think we want to see, though, is everything be above board, everything be fair, no undue influence of privately going to legislators and trying to kill something. Let's be public about it. And let's talk specifics, not in these like high-level vagaries. I think that would be most healthy.
Quick final thoughts, Connor and Christine, both of you. How are you feeling? Optimistic at this point when you're looking at the numbers?
Very optimistic. It's always disheartening when your opposition is misleading and lying and doing dirty tactics. I remember during the signature gathering phase, they had people going to our signers, petition signers, claiming, "Oh, we're with the group that got this initiative. We just need to pull it off the ballot now. We need to fix some things." All these deceitful misrepresentations. We hear the radio ads right now, financed by Walter Plum, the guy who thinks medical cannabis users are repugnant. That they're claiming that medical marijuana is already legal and Proposition 2 is only recreational. I'm a policy wonk. I love getting knee-to-knee with people who disagree. Let's find where we agree. Let's try and persuade one another. What I find disheartening is when all of the deception kind of comes in an attempt to change people's minds in a deceitful way. If someone wants to oppose Prop 2, I got no problem with you, right? If you have sincere concerns, totally fine. But if my neighbor is duped because of your effort, then I've got a problem with that. I think that's what we could do without. And even notwithstanding those efforts, I think Proposition 2 passes very strongly.
Final thought?
My final thoughts, my forethoughts, my thoughts always are with patients. I started this fight as a patient. I'm still a patient, and I'm still struggling today. But we're not going to stop. This initiative is going to pass, but it's going to need help, and I'm going to be here watching it and being a voice for patients until implementation happens. Because honestly, for me, the goal line is when a patient can walk into a dispensary after being diagnosed with cancer and get the recommendation so they can get through their chemo or use cannabis as an alternative option to chemo. That, to me, is the goal line. So while I'm extremely excited about November, there's a long road still ahead of us. And I hope that the church is sincere in them wanting to help those who are suffering, because I have received the phone calls. I have seen the messages on our social media about their members who are distraught over the lies and the deception that their faith is propagating out into the community.
It's Christine Stenquist, president, co-founder of the advocacy group TRUCE, that's Together for Responsible Use and Cannabis Education. I know that wasn't easy, but thank you.
Thank you.
Connor Boyack, president of the Libertas Institute, a Utah-based libertarian think tank. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Dr. Dan Cottom, surgeon practicing in Utah and Nevada. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.